From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. The House will send an article of impeachment to the Senate tonight. That will trigger a trial. Senators will have to decide whether to convict former President Trump for inciting a riot at the Capitol. Meanwhile, the current president, Joe Biden, is racing to push his agenda through a divided Congress. NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell joins us now with the latest. And Kelsey, the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says that the article of impeachment will reach the Senate right before 7 o'clock tonight. What happens then?
Well, so what we're going to see today is kind of a ceremonial process. Democrats in the House are going to carry the article of impeachment, that single article for incitement to insurrection, from the House floor to the Senate. It will be delivered there and read. After that, they basically are underway for a trial, but in a slightly different way than we saw with the first impeachment of President Trump last year. First, they will swear in members of the Senate as jurors tomorrow, and then pretrial briefs will begin. Those will be due on the 8th, and then the trial itself can start on the 9th. So we're kind of in a stage where it's ceremonial and then behind closed doors as everybody kind of prepares for the big public arguments that are to come.
Got it. So as you say, there's sort of this waiting period, and that's partly because Republicans wanted the former President Trump to have more time to prepare his legal team. What do we know about that team?
All we really know is that Butch Bowers is the only person named from his legal team. You know, the president is or the Trump is no longer president. He won't have the benefit of a White House counsel. He won't have all of the support of the federal government behind him. And the people that have represented him in the past will not be available. So we don't know a lot about his impeachment team, aside from the fact that he has chosen Butch Bowers.
And it's notable that even though many Republicans wanted to make sure he had enough time to prepare his defense, that doesn't mean that they are all in his corner this time. What do we know about how many Republican senators might be willing to break and actually vote to convict him?
That is the question that I think everybody in Washington is asking, including a lot of Republicans on Capitol Hill. You know, we do know that there are a small number of Republicans who have said that they are open to impeachment or that they thought impeachment was a good idea. The bar that we are watching right now is 17. 17 Republicans is what it would take for to vote with all of the Democrats to convict President Trump of this article of impeachment, which is a very high bar. I have not, in kind of looking through statements and people's positions, found kind of a combination that gets you to 17. So it will be very difficult for the Democrats presenting their argument in the House to reach that bar of conviction, though that is certainly their goal.
Of course, there was one last time in Mitt Romney from Utah. There's a big gap between 1 and 17.
Certainly.
Kelsey, we have only 2 weeks now. It seems like it's going to be awfully fast in the sense that that doesn't leave a whole lot of time before the trial begins for President Biden to confirm his cabinet picks. I'm mindful that President Trump or former President Trump didn't round out his cabinet until late April. So is there enough time to finish that process?
Well, that is a big concern for Democrats, and that is part of the reason why they agreed to this request from Minority Leader McConnell to delay the start of the trial. You know, McConnell said that it was in part about making sure that there was time for Trump's legal team to prepare, but it was also in part because, you know, there are some things that the Senate just needs to get down on the Senate floor. And people may recall that once an impeachment trial begins, senators are on the floor in their seats for the duration of the time that arguments are being made. And that is 6 days a week, all day long, unless they're able to come up with some sort of agreement to split time, which politically speaking just doesn't seem to be coming together right now. So it's possible that Biden will get a number of cabinet picks confirmed between now and then, but the totality of his cabinet is certainly a question at this point.
Well, you know, as you mentioned, Kelsey, there is this sort of background tension between the two parties about how they're going to work together in this divided chamber. And one of the things that the minority leader, Mitch McConnell, is really pushing for is for Democrats to preserve the filibuster. Chuck Schumer's not making any promises. What's going on there?
There is certainly a tension there. Republicans say that they maintained the filibuster even in times when it was challenging, when they were having trouble getting legislation through. And they say that it is an important tool of the minority party to be able to have a say in the legislation that moves through Congress. Now, people may remember the filibuster is that 60-vote procedural threshold that legislation has to go through in order to get to a final vote on the Senate floor. Now, that it is only for legislation at this point because Democrats did away with that filibuster for judges during a blockade from McConnell and Republicans during the Obama years. So this is not a new debate. The fight over the filibuster has been going on and on on and on as the two parties try to wrangle with how to pass legislation in an increasingly polarized Washington.
Yeah, there's always the short game to play, and then there's the question of whether in the long run does it come back to bite you when the other party is in power. And oh, by the way, we didn't even get to the COVID stimulus package, which Biden is also hoping to pass before starting this trial. So that's also something to watch. And NPR's congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell will keep her eyes on it for us. Thank you, Kelsey.
Thanks for having me.
And speaking of that stimulus package, President Biden's $1.9 trillion plan also includes help for millions of people who are out of work. And today, the president is signing an executive order to boost U.S. manufacturing. Joining us now for a look at the economy is Andrew Stettner, a senior fellow with the Century Foundation, which is a progressive think tank. Andrew, welcome. We're still seeing about 900,000 people a week filing for unemployment in this country. How would you describe the state of the economic crisis that President Biden has inherited?
I think he's had picking up the economy, and thanks for having me, at a very low point. Perhaps a nadir, given the way in which the surge in the pandemic cut off the recovery and increased layoffs towards the end of the year, and alongside it, unemployment claims. It's really all about the vaccine. That's the light in the tunnel. As this program moves forward, the economy can recover, but not before then.
Yeah, and let's talk about how President Biden is addressing it. It is still early, but today he's signing the Buy America executive order that would help spur U.S. factories. Is that any different than what Trump did, and will it work?
I think it will inspire a more aggressive action. Plus, he's put a team in place that hopefully can do a better job at following through. Under the Trump administration, the rhetoric around Buy America and manufacturing was certainly always there, but the follow-through wasn't. And when it comes to something like Buy America, it's really all about the loopholes and the details. And I am confident that the direction and the team around this administration will do better to make sure that when taxpayer dollars are spent, it translates into American jobs.
So those are the executive orders. There's also an effort in Congress, of course. Lawmakers approved some help for people out of work with last month's COVID relief bill. And then now the Biden administration wants to extend those benefits through September. What do you make of the Biden legislative agenda so far?
You know, I think we are very pleased. And I think the $1.9 trillion package, struck the right notes. It has both the public health provisions that are needed to boost jobs and help, the process of economic recovery. And when it comes to the unemployed, it would extend what have been very effective and popular programs of unemployment benefits, extend them to gig workers and those who usually left out, plus what would now be a $400 per week top off in unemployment benefits. Mm-hmm. And critically, because those don't reach everybody and people were left off of them through most of the fall, and they would increase the stimulus payment from just $600 a week per person to $2,000 per person. So that combination were some of the critical anti-poverty programs in this. Taken together, it really will prevent millions of Americans from falling into poverty because the economy has not recovered. These are people that have been there really through no fault of their own.
So what do you say to some senators who are reluctant to spend more on another COVID relief bill?
If we don't invest the money now, we are going to handicap the ability of the economy to recover. We can't wait until the situation gets bad and try to act retroactively. We have been down this road before. During the financial crisis, we thought we passed a big stimulus. Pretty much everyone found out that it was too small pretty soon, but there wasn't the political will to act again. So we need to act now in this package to make sure the economy has the fuel to recover. And also, families are at the end of their rope at being out of work for 9 months at this period. There's nothing left in their savings. They strain their family relationships. We need to make sure that they have a bridge. We don't usually know where the light in the end of the tunnel is, but we can actually see it now, with the vaccine production. But we cannot cut people off until we get there. And I am hopeful that we will extend these unemployment benefits in particular, to at least the end of September, like the president has asked.
It's interesting that what we've been talking about are, ultimately short-term fixes to the unemployment crisis. What should Biden and Congress do to address these problems over the long term?
You know, we need to have structural process, you know, starting with the application and infrastructure. People waited months. There probably are a few million that still haven't got paid their benefits off of last year. We need to fix that with the right technology. We need to have rules that equalize things regardless of what state you're working in and living in. And lastly, we should not leave the critical issue of additional benefits during a recession up to the whim of Congress. There should be automatic triggers related to the level of unemployment in the country at the time.
Andrew Stentner, Senior Fellow at the Century Foundation, a progressive think tank. Andrew, thanks for your insights. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That is the title track off of Bela Fleck's Throw Down Your Heart, The Complete Africa Sessions. The reissue is up for a Grammy for Best Historical Album. It was all the way back in 2005 when Fleck went to Africa to explore the origins of the banjo. He toured through Uganda, Tanzania, Gambia, and Mali, jamming with local musicians along the way. The music they made inspired a documentary film and two albums, including one called The Ripple Effect, which are all part of the Grammy-nominated release. And one of the standouts from that trip is Basse Kukuyate, who plays the ngoni, a traditional instrument in Mali. In honor of the album's Grammy nomination, we called Kuyate at his home in Bamako.
Yes, I'm Bamako now. I'm very sorry for my English. My English is very, very bad.
Oh, it sounds good to me, but that's why we have our interpreter here. So Karen is going to help us, and she will be great. Okay. So don't worry about that.
Yeah, I'm ready.
And the first question I had was, what is the ngoni?
It's a string instrument. It's the father of the banjo and the grandfather of the guitar.
Wow. And how deep are the traditions of the ngoni in Mali?
The ngoni is one of the most traditional of Malian instruments. It's been around since before the period of Christ, and at this point we play it at marriages, we play it at baptisms, we play it at all our ceremonies. It's really one of the most important parts of our musical tradition.
And you say that your family, the Kuyates, are griots, or keepers of customs, and I think that's related to what you're saying there. It's related to your music. What does that mean?
We were the family that kept those traditions alive. My great-grandfather was counsel to an ancient king. We are the journalists. We are the tellers of the people. We are journalists.
You have such a musical family. Your wife, Amy Sacco, is a singer, and in fact, she appears on Throw Down Your Heart with you and Bela. Can we listen? This is called Kanjo. Beautiful. Do you think that your children will continue that musical tradition?
My father made music, his father made music, his grandfather made music, and it went that way all the way back before Jesus Christ. And now my children are doing the same thing. It's a custom for centuries and centuries and centuries. Bela came to find out about it because, as you may know, Africans brought the banjo to the United States.
Wow. And when you met Bela Fleck, the two of you picked up your instruments and you started to play together. Let's listen to some of that. What was it like to have an American banjo player come to your town and play with you?
Bela, c'est pas seulement un joueur de banjo. Bela, c'est une machine.
Bela isn't just a banjo player. He's a machine. A machine. That man is a machine. I never knew a man like that.
Huh. When you play the ngoni, how do you feel inside your body?
C'est comme mon sang qui est dans mon veine.
This instrument for me, it's in my veins. When I touch it, I think of the birth of ngoni right through until the present. It's like it's in my blood.
Hey, Bela!
Paseku!
Hey, Bela, how you doing, man?
Before we let Basse Kukuyate go, Bella Fleck joined us on the line, and the musicians had a moment to reconnect. It had been years since Fleck's 2005 trip, and now their album, exploring the roots of the banjo in Africa, is on the verge of winning a Grammy.
I'm great. It's good to hear your voice. How are you?
I'm fine. And you, good?
I'm doing great, yeah. I mean, considering insanity.
Yes, good, good. I'm very happy.
Great to hear you.
Okay, man.
I miss
you. Thank you. Bye.
So, Bela Fleck, welcome. It is really good to speak with you, and it was great to hear Baseko say there that you are a banjo machine. What was it like to hear his voice again?
You know, Baseko was just such a fun guy to hang out with, and he has this big energy. And, of course, when he plays, it's unreal. So, I mean, it's just a very happy sound to hear him again. I love him.
You know, I do think it's interesting, this idea that you were exploring the origins of the banjo, among other things. Could you talk about that for a minute?
Well,
what did you find? Yeah.
Well, here's the thing about that. I didn't find anything out that I didn't know already. I already knew the banjo came from Africa. I already knew it came from probably the Gambia or Western countries around the Gambia. But going there and experiencing the musicians and the instruments there in person was a whole different level of experience. And then I was able to film it and hopefully share that experience with people back here. I'm also a bit of an outsider to the bluegrass world in that I come from New York City. And there's always sort of a question mark, why do you play the banjo anyway? You know, you're from the Upper West Side in Manhattan. As I found out more and more about the banjo, it wasn't a Southern white instrument in its origins at all. It was from Africa.
Bela, just to connect the dots on the history here of the banjo, is that the reason it rose up in the American South and became what it is today is because enslaved Africans brought it here.
Yeah, and what happened was that as white folks appropriated it, they wore blackface and sang songs about how awesome it was on the old plantation. And that really rubbed people the wrong way back in the day. You know, it hadn't been very long since they were slaves. So they were like, we don't want that instrument anymore. And when the guitar showed up in jazz, people dropped the banjo like it was a hot coal. And then it had this resurgence in the South by white players such as Earl Scruggs, who sort of brought the banjo back from death's door. I mean, it was really going away. And he brought this whole new way of playing the banjo no one had ever done before. For me, I can pick up a banjo anytime and have a good time. It's an instrument that just makes you feel really good while you're playing it.
So do you think your own banjo playing changed as a result of what you saw and encountered in Africa? I remember a scene from the film when you're, and this was a musician playing the guitar, but you were shocked at what he was able to do with the guitar. It was so different, I could tell, from anything that you'd seen before. I just wonder if any of that has influenced your music today, now that it's been so many years since you've been back.
Yeah, that was Jelimadi. Jelimadi uses a lot of Ngoni techniques on the guitar, and Ngoni, of course, is what Baseko plays. So all of the techniques that I was exposed to and that I had to learn to interact with have made me a better banjo player and just added more facets to my grab bag of ideas and techniques and musical phrases that are accessible to me now.
Let's talk about the ripple effect for just a moment. This was an entirely new album that was recorded with a new musician that you weren't able to meet on your trip to Africa. That's Toumani Diabaté. Tell us about him.
Well, Toumani Diabaté is one of the great instrumentalists of the world. He plays the kora. He also lives in Bamako, where Baseko lives. But unfortunately, when I went to Bamako, he was out of town, and he only got back on the day we left, so we didn't even get to meet. But we ran into each other at a folk festival in Winnipeg, Canada. And so they threw us on the stage, you know, with no rehearsal. And all of a sudden, there we were, face-to-face for the first time. And we just got up on stage and went.
Well, let's listen to some of the music from that album. This is something that people might recognize. It's Dueling Banjos. It was heard on the soundtrack of the film Deliverance. Here's your version of it with Toumani.
I
I love it. People all around the country are either stomping their foot right now or having flashbacks to the movie.
Yeah, they're either horrified or they think it's great. Yeah, I've been trying to not play that song for 40 years. And when I got together with Tumani, I thought, well, now this is a weird enough situation to actually play that song. But I have to say, the real joy in playing with him were these long meditative pieces where we would just groove and take turns and build this hypnotic, rippling, magical effect. Because really what the kora does, very much like the banjo, is it ripples. That's what it does well. You alternate your fingers and you create all these ostinatos, and that's what the banjo does well. So all we had to do was put our ripples together and we were in business.
You know, I can't help but ask, you released this album and re-released Throw Down Your Heart last year when the Black Lives Matter movement drew so much more attention to issues like cultural appropriation. And of course, this album was made many years before that. But did you have to think about that when you were sort of re-releasing this project and you made it so many years ago? Is it tricky?
To me, it was the opposite, because it was clearly stating that the banjo comes from Africa and just sort of offering up proof of it. When I made this film, it just wasn't as well understood by people that the banjo was from Africa. A lot of people thought I was crazy. I had arguments with people about where the banjo came from. And for me, it was all about pointing the light back to the truth about the banjo.
Banjo great Bela Fleck, his reissue of Throw Down Your Heart is nominated for a Grammy for Best Historical Album. Bela, as always, great to speak with you. Thanks for making some time for us.
My pleasure.
We'll link you to more at hereandnow.org. And by the way, thanks to our producer, Karen Miller Medson, for helping us out with the French.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
We are still in the middle of this pandemic, and right now, having science news you can trust, from variants to vaccines, is essential. NPR Shortwave has your back. About 10 minutes every weekday, listen and subscribe to Shortwave, the daily science podcast from NPR.
At this time last year, the Chinese city of Wuhan was in lockdown.
The city is the epicenter of a never-before-seen type of virus related to SARS. More than 570 people have been sickened in China so far, with at least 17 dead. The travel
suspension. That's NPR's Emily Feng on January 23rd, 2020. The disease caused by that never-before-seen virus she described would soon be known as COVID-19. China sealed off Wuhan, home to 11 million people, to try to stop its spread. The Wuhan lockdown began with a notice sent to people's smartphones at 2 a.m. announcing the airport and train stations would be shut down later that morning. The lockdown would last 76 days, ending on April 8th. Emily Feng was back in Wuhan last week, and while she was there, she spoke with my colleague Tanya Mosley, who asked how the city has changed.
I mean, it's almost literally like night and day. I visited a number of the sites that I had reported from early last year. Last year, they were dark and deserted, completely empty because people were still not allowed to leave their homes or apartments. Now you go back and the streets are not crowded, but there are people around, there's music playing, the signs are up again, stores are open, people are eating together in restaurants. The signs of life are really palpable, and the contrast is really stark. There are people driving on the streets again. Life has basically returned back to normal, with certain restrictions. I mean, people still have to get COVID tests, for example, if they travel outside of the city. And people still scan these little digital health certificates showing that they haven't been in close contact with virus cases in the last 7 days when they enter taxis or restaurants.
We know that a team of World Health Organization officials arrived there last week to investigate the origins of the virus. We were hearing that they were quarantined first. Have they started their work?
They will get out mid-next week. So they've been quarantining for just over a week now. They have less than a week left to go. It's not clear how much investigation they're going to be able to do. They will be accompanied by Chinese scientists that health authorities here have chosen. So, and it's been more than a year now since the virus first emerged in humans here in Wuhan. Since that time, samples have been destroyed. The seafood market where the first human cases were identified has been closed down and much of the equipment inside burned. So people are curious as to what they might actually find.
Wow. I mean, does the government say now that the origins of the virus actually started there? Do they admit that it started in Wuhan?
Government officials in China have obfuscated. Certain officials have even gone so far as to suggest that the virus was brought in from another country and that the first human cases did not begin in Wuhan. In fact, they might not have begun in China. Now, there's no proof that this is actually the case, but what's striking is when you talk to people in Wuhan, even some people who were among the first wave of seafood vendors to get sick in the city, they will tell you that they think it did not begin in China. Many of them believe that it began in the U.S., that it was brought to Wuhan. And although this is a conspiracy theory with no evidence, it's one that I found when I was reporting here in Wuhan last year. And it's one that's gained even more traction now that I've come back.
Oh, this will be very interesting to follow the World Health Organization investigation and what they find. That's NPR's Emily Feng in Wuhan. Emily, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that was my colleague Tanya Mosley speaking with NPR's Emily Feng. Florida reported more than 9,000 new confirmed coronavirus cases on Sunday. That's a drop in daily new infections since a peak earlier this month, but the state has struggled to coordinate a vaccine rollout that some critics call chaotic. Let's get an update now from Danielle Pryor. She's a reporter with member station WMFE in Orlando. And Danielle, your state's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis recently boasted that 1 million senior citizens had been vaccinated and then had to walk that claim back. So do we know how many people actually have been vaccinated in Florida?
Right. So when it comes to seniors, only about 800,000. So they had to release a statement later that day saying near 1 million. But it has been quite slow here. Like you said, we were one of the first states to allow anyone 65 and older to get vaccinated. But we've had some issues with vaccine tourism and just, you know, like everybody has been struggling across the country just to get enough supply of these vaccines to really get everybody vaccinated who's ready to be.
Interesting. So as you say, you were one of the states that just allowed everybody over 65 to get vaccinated. And we initially saw some long lines of seniors. What's the latest? Is that still the situation?
It is. The lines are long. Publix, usually when they post available vaccine appointments, those appointments are gone within 2 to 3 hours on the online appointment system. So we're seeing a very high demand. And, you know, basically now Publix, Walmart, Winn-Dixie will soon be joining Publix, is joining, you know, local Department of Health throughout the state in trying to get these vaccines to people. But here in Orange County, just to give you an example, we're vaccinating people in the parking lot of the Orange County Convention Center, which is just this huge facility. So it gives you a sense of the demand for those vaccines. In Volusia County, they have had vaccine events at the camp and fairgrounds. So there's a huge demand for these vaccines.
Danielle, you mentioned a phrase that was new to me, vaccine tourism, right? Fun,
right.
Sun, and vaccines, I guess, in Florida. But what about the people who are snowbirds, right? They wouldn't maybe call themselves tourists. They have a second home down there. Can they get the vaccine in Florida?
They can. You know, last Thursday, there was this kind of new public advisory that came down that said you either have to be a part-time or full-time resident. So basically, if you're a full-time resident, you can show your driver's license or another ID. And if you're a part-time resident, you can show like a mortgage or a rent or utility bill, that sort of thing. But we had some problems with people coming in from other countries and other states who were only here for a day to get the shot. And now those folks obviously can't get the shot anymore. We want to keep it in the state to the folks that live here, whether it's the full year or, you know, 6 months coming down during the hard northern winters.
Sure. And in the moment we have left, Danielle, I mean, how is the state making sure that the vaccine is accessible to everybody who lives in the state? You mentioned some of the places people can go to get vaccinated, but where else can people go to make sure that there's equal access?
There's some new pilot programs that have been rolled out in about 7 counties throughout the state, and these are at churches and underserved areas, Black and brown communities. And so they're having these huge vaccine events so you can go to church and get your shot.
Got it. Well, that's Danielle Pryor. She's a health reporter for member station WMFE in Orlando with the latest on vaccinations in Florida. Danielle, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks so much.
In the European Union, foreign ministers meeting in Brussels today have decided not to impose new sanctions on Russia for now. They were gathering in response to Russia's detention of opposition leader Alexei Navalny. Over the weekend, protesters supporting Navalny clashed with police. Thousands of protesters across Russia were arrested. The BBC's Steve Rosenberg joins us now from Moscow on Skype. And Steve, first of all, these protests looked pretty violent over the weekend. What happened?
Well, these protests took place across this vast country. That's the first thing to say, in more than 100 towns and cities. And on the face of it, you might think the numbers aren't huge. Tens of thousands of people in a country of, what, 145 million? But remember, these are tens of thousands of Russians who came out despite warnings from the authorities that they could be arrested for taking part in illegal protests. These are tens of thousands of Russians who braved the Russian winter to come out and protest. And I think this will give the Kremlin cause for concern, even though the Russian authorities have dismissed them and are trying to dismiss Alexei Navalny as someone who does not pose a threat to them. We're already seeing that Vladimir Putin has referred directly to the protests. He was chatting to students today, and he said that everyone has the right in Russia to political activity and to express an opinion within the confines of the law. But anything outside of that, he said, was dangerous. So the message from the Kremlin is, if you take part in unsanctioned illegal protests, this is not good for the country. And he provided lots of historical examples of why unsanctioned protest was dangerous. He talked about the Russian Revolution of 1917. He even talked about the crowd that seized the U.S. Capitol early this month. So the message being sent by the Kremlin to the people is, do not take to the streets to protest against the authorities.
Now, put this into some context. When was the last time Russia had seen protests this far and wide across the country?
I mean, if you go back a few years, there were big protests in Moscow. You know, up to 100,000 people came out in 2012. But these are quite big. And I think it shows that Alexei Navalny is someone the Kremlin is worried about. You know, for a long time, the Russian authorities made out that he was a nobody, that he was just a blogger. But, I mean, look at what has happened the last week in Russia, ever since Mr. Navalny came back to Russia 5 months after being poisoned by a nerve agent in Siberia. We've had tens of thousands of people taking to the streets across the country. We've seen a bombshell video investigation that Mr. Navalny and his colleagues posted online just a few days ago, alleging that Vladimir Putin had built himself an opulent billion-dollar palace on the Black Sea using illicit funds. And this video has gone absolutely viral online. You know, more than 80 million people have viewed it. And this has put the Kremlin on the back foot. And this is why we've seen Vladimir Putin referring to these allegations today. We've seen Russian state television that doesn't like talking much about Alexei Navalny. It talked a lot about him in its big flagship news program at the weekend. It tried to do a character assassination of him, calling him a phony, a politician on the level of a toilet brush, and claiming that somehow this investigation into a Putin palace was trumped up and put together by NATO secret services, and the German state had sent Mr. Navalny on a mission back to Russia to provoke unrest.
And what do we know about Navalny's safety right now? I mean, the Russian government just tried unsuccessfully to assassinate him. Now he's in their custody in a Russian jail.
It's astonishing, isn't it? I mean, the whole story, if it is true, as Mr. Navalny believes, that the president of Russia ordered his assassination, that's something the Kremlin denies. But if that is true, then you would assume that Mr. Navalny is in danger. In fact, a few days ago, he posted a message from the jail he's in saying that just in case something happened to him, making it clear that this would not be suicide. Just getting that message out, just in case.
Well, we mentioned that the ministers in the European Union are pushing for new sanctions against Russia after these protests. How effective has all this been in terms of cranking up the pressure on Vladimir Putin? And do you expect any concessions from him?
I don't know if the word concession is in Vladimir Putin's dictionary. I mean, we've seen lots of Western sanctions against Russia over the last few years. Did that make Vladimir Putin return Crimea to Ukraine? No, it didn't. Vladimir Putin is not used to giving in to Western pressure. In fact, he takes Western pressure, Western sanctions, and he converts it into a threat. And he goes to the people and says, look, the West is out to get us. We have to rally around the government. I don't think it's very likely that sanctions or resolutions condemning the Kremlin will have much effect.
The BBC's Moscow correspondent, Steve Rosenberg. Thank you very much, Steve.
You're welcome.
President Biden faces a slew of challenges and big-ticket issues in his first 100 days, not the least of which is providing immediate pandemic relief. These early days are critical for setting the tone of his presidency and the future of the United States, which is why Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic, believes President Biden needs to look back and learn from the mistakes made by the Obama administration, in which he was, of course, the vice president. Derek Thompson joins us now from Washington, as he does every Monday. Hey there, Derek.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Glad to have you back. And you argue that Biden should draft policy that is, quote, big, fast, and simple, especially when it comes to addressing the pandemic economy. So how would that be different from what we saw under the Obama administration? And why would a different approach be important?
I think it's really interesting to juxtapose the situation that Biden is walking into with that of his predecessor, Barack Obama. You know, both were walking into a period of unified government for Democrats. Both were walking into a deep recession. You look back and Obama passed a then record stimulus act in 2009, followed by the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. And you could look at those achievements and say, well, you know, those were both historic achievements, but there's two big problems with them. They were too subtle and they were too small. And their subtlety and their smallness resulted in Democrats losing horrifically in the midterms of 2010. A point on the subtlety of the stimulus. What the economists in the White House wanted to do in 2009 was they didn't want to give people checks. They made it obvious they were getting money. They wanted to trick them into thinking that they somehow sneakily were getting more money by reducing the payroll tax withholding formula so that people would look at their bank accounts after they get their biweekly checks and say, wow, I have a lot more money or a little bit more money than I thought I would have otherwise. This worked. I mean, this technically did give people money. This was the tax cut in the 2009 stimulus. But it was so sneaky that no one knew it existed. No one gave Obama credit for that tax cut. And what I'm telling the Biden White House to focus on is policies that are not only big and not only fast, but that are also simple, that people can feel in their lives and give Biden credit for. And that's why I think that the stimulus checks that are being talked about, the $1,000 to $2,000 checks, are such a good popular policy. They're a great way for the Biden administration to give people money in a way that they will recognize it is the Biden White House doing it.
Well, and maybe to that point, Derek, you remember when the first round of checks came from the Trump administration, the president at that time really wanted to have his name on some of those checks to make sure people knew that they were coming from him and he wanted credit. And so I'm curious whether, you know, this approach that you're advocating to be, you're right that he should make his policies as stupidly straightforward as possible. He seems to be somewhat on board with that, telling his aides that, you know, if the policies they're drafting aren't understandable for their grandmothers, that they need to start over. And so I'm curious whether this kind of move away from wonkiness is actually one way in which he's maybe borrowing from President Trump, because even Trump's detractors would say he was a good marketer.
Well, look, I think you nailed it. I didn't put it that way in the piece, but I think that's a beautiful summary of the point that I was making, that Biden is a kind of synthesis between the policy instincts of Barack Obama and the straightforwardly obvious instincts of Donald Trump, where everything was about obviousness. Everything was about the showmanship of making sure that people knew everything that he was doing at every single second. My conclusion to this article was that in many ways, since Biden is trying to deepen the accomplishments of Barack Obama in terms of health care, in terms of helping people who are, you know, lower income or, you know, need welfare spending, that the one-line summary of his edit on Obama's style of governance should be once more with feeling. We should make sure that we deepen universal health care and that we deepen welfare, but do so in a way, Biden is thinking, such that people give him credit for it. And that, I think, is what's so important, that you want to ditch the technocratic nudges of 2009 and 2010 and replace them with straightforward policy that people can immediately associate with the accomplishments of a Biden White House.
I like how you're channeling your internal choir director there, and one more round, but with feeling. But I have to ask you, though, Derek. I mean, could there be a risk here of backfiring in the sense that if you draft a policy that's too simple, maybe you've, you know, overlooked something, and there's some unintended consequence that can come back to bite you?
Absolutely. You absolutely can. I don't want to suggest that somehow going for awesomeness and going for simplicity is a foolproof plan. There's lots of things that could go wrong. First of all, if you spend so much time thinking about how people are going to react to your policy, maybe you won't spend enough time thinking about how the policy should be designed, and you end up designing policy that isn't particularly good. On the other hand, I think that it's very easy for me to write, you know, sit at my desk and write big, fast, and simple. It's much harder for someone in the White House to craft big, fast, and simple policies that are going to get through Democrats' bare majority in the Senate, especially when you have conservative Democrats like Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia, who might not be on board with a plan that is as progressive as what Biden's talking about. So you're absolutely right. There are risks in going too simple. There are risks in aiming for that intersection of policy wisdom and public approval. But I think that Biden should aim for that intersection anyway.
All right. We'll see if he's listening and if he follows your advice. That's Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic. Thanks.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.